Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 80 countries around the world over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on the Kwok Ting Test when we come back. Well, the lessons on courtroom strategy and procedure that you hear on this program are just a small part of my 2-week basic courtroom strategy and procedure school. And this class includes lessons on what to do and what not to do at the scene of the alleged crime, and what you should say to the police or investigators, and what you ought not to say to the police. And you'll learn how to conduct yourself in your case at bail setting, arraignment, pleadings, motion hearings, trial, and appeal. And you'll learn how to ask questions, cross-examine adverse witnesses, select a jury, introduce exhibits and evidence, and conduct discovery, and do the legal research and follow the rules of court. Now, there are 28 elements, 28 things that you need to learn in courtroom strategy and procedure. Rule 1 is that all of the evidence that your opponent is ever going to use against you is going to be furnished by you. So keep your mouth shut, don't say anything, and then shut up. And after Rule 1 is out of the way, we can get to the real business of winning your case. Now, if you'd like more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, call us here at the law school. The number's 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, be sure to ask for my free general law CD package first. That's the place to start. It's a 4-hour commentary on the law school, and it's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative, it's free. You can call and order one right now. Courtroom strategy and procedure is also available on compact disc for adult home education. If you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Just click on the email and send us an email request for your free general law CD package. Again, that's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. Do it right now before you forget. All right, we're talking about a subject here called the Kwok Ting Test. It's not something that very many people will hear about. You probably have never heard the name Kwok Ting. He was a Chinese fella, 16-year-old boy. Came here to the United States, at least that was his claim, and said that he had been born here. Now, he couldn't speak English, he couldn't identify any landmarks in San Francisco, but he said he was born there and that he'd spent his first 10 years there, went to China for 6 years, and now he came back to the United States and was claiming that he should be landed in San Francisco because he was a citizen of the United States. Now, the Supreme Court of the United States, listening to the case back in 1891, came to a different conclusion. And they came up with a 3-part test. And they said that the testimony has to be complete, and Kwok Ting's wasn't. He said the testimony must contain extemporaneous detail, and Kwok Ting didn't, and that the testimony must be supported by witnesses and evidence, and his was not. And so they ruled against him. Now, from that case, though, those of us that study law, study court cases, learn from that. And what we learn from that is that there's a modality, there is a test, there is a way that Kwok Ting could have proven his case, but he either didn't know how, or perhaps for some other reason that we don't know about, failed, and therefore he lost his case. So the rule that we follow here at the law school is we want to do what the winners do, and we want to avoid what the losers did so that we can become a consistent winner. Now, as an example, if you were to file a writ of habeas corpus, statistically, only one writ of habeas corpus out of 100, that's 1%, actually work. So if you want your writs of habeas corpus to work, then you have to put yourself into that 1% 100% of the time. An appeal only works 1% of the time. So if you take 100 cases, not everybody appeals to start with. But if you take 100 cases that have been appealed, only one of those appeals out of 100 is going to succeed. So if you want your appeal to succeed, then you have to be in that 1% envelope 100% of the time. Otherwise, you're just going to be a part of that 99% that fail. As a result of that, most people have a very dim view of the judicial process. As another example, 94% of all criminal prosecutions are won by the government or by the prosecutor. Only 6% are won by the defendant, like O.J. Simpson. And as a result of that, people have a fatalistic view of their experience in court. They believe that, well, there's no justice here. Most of that is caused by a misunderstanding. That misunderstanding is, are you guilty or not? Most criminal defendants are, in fact, guilty. Statistically, it's 85%. So if you're in the traffic court and you're watching, 85% of the people who walk through there are, in fact, guilty of what the policeman said they did. And I'm not complaining about the policeman doing his job. I mean, after all, that's why we hire the guys and girls. They're there to keep order. And if we didn't have them, we wouldn't have order. We would have chaos. I know sometimes people call me a tax protester. Hell, I'm not protesting any taxes. That I'm anti-government. I'm not anti-government. We have to have government, for crying out loud. The only people who don't have government are anarchists and savages, for crying out loud. What I'm opposed to is lying policemen. What I'm opposed to is convictions of innocent people. I'm opposed to the police breaking the law. I think that policemen need to obey the law like everybody else. Just like judges and presidents, I think Mr. Bush needs to obey the law just like all the rest of us do. That they got rules out here, you know, when you're playing, just picture this, you know, say you're playing a game. And the guy that you're playing with is cheating. He's not following the rules. Well, do you want to play a game with somebody that doesn't follow the rules? And the same thing is true here in the real world. Now, we complain a lot, you know, about Halliburton and no competitive bids and the war in Iraq and so on. Jesus made an observation one time of the Pharisees. You know, they were complaining a lot. And he said, you know, you guys strain at gnats and swallow camels. You strain at gnats and you swallow camels. All right. Now, last time we took a look at a government policeman, a witness, a government agent who got on the witness stand and lied. And we uncovered his lie, and we lived happily ever after. And so I pointed out to you, you see, you can get on the witness stand, and you can tell your story, and then if it's the truth, you can weather the cross-examination. But if you're getting on the witness stand and lying, a good skilled cross-examiner is going to eat your lunch, like F. Lee Bailey ate Mark Furman's lunch. Right, now, there's another type of witness that we need to examine, and that's the witness who gets on the witness stand and lies. But he, honest to God, believes he's telling the truth. Now, boy, that's tough. I mean, that's tougher than the lying cop that comes in. The cop that comes in and lies about you, we can eat his lunch all day long. But there's a tougher witness. A tougher witness. And that's an honest-to-God school teacher who comes in and gets on the witness stand, raises her hand, swears to tell the truth, and she believes that the lies she is telling is in fact the truth, and we have to impeach her testimony. Now, if she's lying, we can do that. If she's telling the truth, we probably can't. I mean, after all, if somebody is telling the truth, how in the hell are you going to get that person to lie, to retract, to recant the truth? Oh, that isn't going to happen. Now, there was a case that came down. In fact, it isn't just a case. There's lots of cases that come down like this. But believe it or not, there are 23 techniques that are available to us, and we can uncover the truth even from a witness who's lying, who actually believes the lies they're telling is the truth. And it requires a special technique, and here's what it is. Professor Hugo Munsterberg, for many years professor of psychology at Harvard University, published a few years ago his book on this subject entitled On the Witness Stand. And I think I may fairly claim to have introduced this book to the local legal profession in a course of lectures that I delivered at the Columbia Law School, but my partner, Herbert C. Smith, was the first New York lawyer to actually make practical use of its theories in one of his cases and thereby completely break down the damaging testimony of a witness, of whose honesty of purpose there could be no question. It was in a case tried some years ago before Justice Erlanger of our state Supreme Court. The suit was brought by the widow to recover a large sum of damages from Macy and Company, owners of a well-known department store in New York City, on account of the death of Professor John T. McNulty. The plaintiff's estate, a professor of philosophy in the College of the City of New York, met his death by falling through an open passenger elevator shaft at one of the upper floors of the building. The claim on behalf of the widow was that as Professor McNulty approached the elevator walking along the corridor on the sixth floor and intending to enter the elevator, the waiting elevator suddenly shot up before the barricading door was closed, and the professor stepping into the unguarded shaft was precipitated to the bottom, whereupon he died. Now, on the other hand, the elevator operator, Macy and Company's only witness, insisted that Professor McNulty was not entering the elevator car at all, but on the contrary, had ridden in the car up to the floor in question, and that it was customary to stop the car at each landing, and that just as he, the operator, was starting it again and closing the collapsible door, the professor suddenly realized that he wished to get off, pushed back and the partly closed door, stepped out, lost his balance, and fell backwards into the shaft. Now, the case, therefore, directly turned on whether Professor McNulty fell while attempting to enter the car, or he fell while he was leaving the car. If it was the former, then Macy and Company were liable for their employee's negligence. If, in fact, it was the latter, then it was the deceased's own fault. He was the proximate cause of his own injury. Now, the plaintiff called Dr. Allison as her principal and only eyewitness to the accident. Dr. Allison testified on direct examination that Professor McNulty walked past him on the sixth floor corridor toward the elevator shaft, which was open, and he saw him disappear there and heard the fall of his body. Dr. Allison had originally told his version of the occurrence 2 days after the accident at the coroner's inquest when he was asked by the lawyer for the deceased's family the following leading questions, there being no representative of Macy's and Company present. All right, now the first examination that we're going to look at here is the coroner's inquest. Now, Dr. Allison testified at the coroner's inquest concerning Professor McNulty's death. And he testified to leading and suggestive questions in that inquest. Now, that's typically improper. Anytime that we have questions and answers, we should have advocates for both sides present. And the questions ought not to be leading and suggestive. The questions ought to be probative in value. Now, the difference is this. If I asked you a leading and suggestive question, it would be, are you still beating your wife on Wednesday? It's leading, it's suggestive, and it assumes facts, not in evidence. It's forked. It's totally improper. And it's the classic question when we're illustrating an improper question. Are you still beating your wife on Wednesday? The correct way to ask this question is, are you married? Do you beat your wife? Do you beat your wife on any particular day of the week? And is the day of the week that you beat your wife Wednesday? Now, that's the correct way to ask that question and to secure those answers. Now, oftentimes, when you're at the police headquarters, the police are asking you leading and suggestive questions. There is no advocate for you there. They are recording every statement that you make. Then they do this several times, and they get conflicting answers for the same questions, which are being asked in different ways, which then shows that you're contradicting yourself, for which at trial they then bring these contradictions forward, produce witnesses against you, and they convict you out of your own mouth. Which is why we use the rule, keep your mouth shut, don't say anything, and shut up. So I told you about Vera Butes. Remember? Vera? The Iron Lady? The lady who said, here's the gun, there's the body, I killed him, and shut up. That's all that needed to be said. Then when she got on the witness stand, she testified as to her actions that night, that it was in self-defense, there being no other witnesses to contradict her, there being no prior statements that she had made that they could use and twist and use against her. And the prosecutor had to go after her cold turkey with just the story that he heard 5 minutes before. And he couldn't do it. And Vera won. Now, did Vera intend to kill the doctor? I don't know. Maybe. Did she get away with murder? I don't know. Maybe. But remember, the rule that we follow in Anglo-Saxon administration is that we would rather turn an innocent man loose than convict, or we would rather turn a guilty man loose, I'm sorry, we'd rather turn a guilty man loose than we would to convict and punish an innocent man. Now, Macy's is a big corporation, and nobody really cares about Macy's or Halliburton or Enron. But in the interest of truth, in the interest of right and wrong, good and bad, righteousness and unrighteousness, what we want to uncover here is, did Dr. Allison tell the truth, or was his testimony manipulated? And the answer is, his testimony was manipulated, and then that testimony was later used by the plaintiff, in this case, to bring an action. Now, the plaintiff probably would not have brought this action had they known the truth to start with. Very seldom do people sue other people if they know that they're wrong to start with. And so it was the fault of the coroner's inquest. So listen to these questions now. Let's see if we can pick up on it. Professor Allison has asked this question. Question. As you were walking along this corridor on the sixth floor, you saw a man's form, which afterwards turned out to be Professor McNulty passing you going toward the elevator shaft. And he answered, yes, sir. Now, that question is totally improper. It's leading and suggestive. It's manipulative. Listen to it again. It says, as you were walking along this corridor. That assumes he was walking along the corridor. We haven't established that fact yet. On the sixth floor. That assumes that it was the sixth floor. It might have been the fourth or the third or the second floor. We haven't established that it was the sixth floor or how he knew it was the sixth floor. You saw a man's form. We haven't established that he saw a man's form. Or anybody's form, or that he saw anybody yet. Which afterwards turned out to be Professor McNulty. Yes, it's true. It did turn out to be Professor McNulty. So we take one piece of truth, and we put three assumptions with it, and the man answers the question, yes, sir. That's the way the police conduct interrogations. Now, should the police conduct an interrogation that way? I don't think so. I don't think that the police should conduct an interrogation unless you have your lawyer or counsel or you have experience there with you to answer the questions. So that when the policeman asks these kinds of leading and suggestive questions, that somebody is there to say objection, leading, suggestive, assumes facts not in evidence, forked. Because this is testimony that's being taken down. It may not be sworn to, but it's still testimony and it's being recorded. And it's going to be used against you. Now, I don't make these rules. You know, I don't come in here and say, well, I'm going to make the rules concerning police interrogations. You know, that's not in my purview. But, you know, when the police ask me questions, I'm smart enough to know I need to shut up. I don't talk to them. I was in jail one time. The police said, well, come on in here, Gordon. We want to talk to you. Well, you don't have any choice there. So I came in. I sat down. I said, well, we'd like to ask you a few questions. I said, okay. And he said, now, what's your name, address, and phone number, and social security number? And I said, am I the subject of a criminal investigation? I said, yes. I said, okay. Then I reserve all of my rights at all times. And I waive none of my rights at any time for any cause or reason. I don't want to talk to you. I don't want to answer any of your questions. And then the guy came back and he said, now listen, you know, if you don't answer our questions over here, you know, we're all going to assume you're guilty. We don't have any other choice. And I said, well, I don't give a rat's rectum whether you agree with me or disagree or whether you like it or don't. I don't want to talk to you. He said, well, why not? I said, because I don't like you. I don't like you. I don't like your looks. I don't like the environment. I don't like the circumstances. I don't want to answer your questions. I don't want to talk to you. I don't want to have anything to do with you. Is that offensive? I don't know. Probably. Was it the truth? It was. Well, they kept after me for a while, and pretty soon I... And I didn't tell them anything, and so they put me back in the cell block. The policeman's going to come in and testify against me anyway. I already know that. And I don't know what he's going to say, but he's not going to say anything that I gave him out of my mouth. He can come in and testify. He was totally uncooperative, and he wouldn't answer any questions. Yeah, that's true. I was totally uncooperative, and I wouldn't answer any questions. So... Now, this Professor Allison, who's a fellow professor here, as it turns out, with Professor McNulty over there, he answered this question incorrectly. There was a second question. He says, and you saw this man disappear after he reached the shaft. The proper way to ask this is, what did you see when Professor McNulty approached the shaft? They didn't ask him, what did you see? They said, and you saw this man disappear. They told him the answer. You saw him disappear down the shaft. We don't know if he saw him disappear down the shaft. He might have been walking in the opposite direction. He might have been looking up at the ceiling. He might have been looking down at the floor. We didn't ask him, did you see him disappear down the shaft? We said, and you saw him disappear down the shaft. And he answered, yes, sir. Question, and then you heard the sound of a body striking the bottom. Yes, sir. Now, it was these obviously leading questions which prompted Mr. Smith to pursue the following line of cross-examination. So, at trial, we're not claiming now that Professor Allison came in here working for the plaintiff and against Macy's with the malign intent of splitting the proceeds, or that he was lying because he didn't like Macy's, or that he was offering perjured testimony for some ulterior motive. This professor testified at the coroner's inquest, and he answered some leading questions. He answered the leading questions incorrectly, as we're going to see as we proceed with the cross-examination at trial. But it's now incumbent, it's much more difficult now to secure the truth after we have this bad testimony put into the record than it would have been had we asked the questions correctly and secured the truth that the coroner's inquest held. There never would have been a lawsuit. So, again, there never would have been a prosecution if the police had asked the questions correctly to start with. But you see, the police have an ulterior motive. They're looking for somebody to prosecute, and they really don't care whether they're prosecuting somebody who's guilty or innocent. It's irrelevant and immaterial. Prosecutors don't give a rat's ass whether they're prosecuting an innocent man or not. So let's wake up and smell the coffee. His job is to secure a conviction. Nothing more, nothing less. Now, in this case, we're not talking about a criminal case. They're not talking about somebody going to prison or somebody going to jail here, but we're talking about money. Somebody's going to lose some money here. And you can say, well, Macy's can afford to lose the money. Well, maybe they can. I wouldn't doubt that. But should they? Just because you've got the money, does that mean we should take it away from you? So I don't think we should be taking it away from Macy's any more than we should be taking it away from you or anybody else. Now, the truth is the truth, and false is false. Right's right, and wrong's wrong. And let me give you a reminder here while we're talking about this Macy's case, and remind you that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard worldwide over the Internet daily. If you'd like more information about the law school or The Law Hour, please go to our website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective, not 8 schools and all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement only. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, then go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated every week. It has a radio log schedule and archives, and that can be accessed through the website as well. Now, the Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events, and we do it 7 days a week. Now, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order one by calling the law school at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. 67. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. And the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that those authors or publications that we endorse or recommend are necessarily going to reciprocate, and that's because most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour may be hostile, political, religious, or they could be economic or sectarian, they can be racial or ethnic partisans. And their viewpoint may not be totally endorsed now by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. These opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine, and they're mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this network or of this local radio station. So if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please go to our website, georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, these stories, these examples, are coming from a book called Wellman on Cross-Examination. It's called The Art of Cross-Examination. The name of the book, The Art of Cross-Examination by Francis L. Wellman. Now, you can get this at any law school bookstore. They'll all have one. You probably could get it from Barnes & Noble. You can certainly get it from a legal publishing house such as Westlaw or Shepherd's McGraw-Hill or somebody like that. It's the standard text used in every law school to train every lawyer in America. There are other books like it. There are other writers, you know, that write about cross-examination. This is probably the best. It is the standard. It is the book that everybody learns from. We all cut our eye teeth, as they say, on The Art of Cross-Examination by Francis L. Wellman, first published back in 1903. It's still in current production and in printing, and it's copyrighted. So I have to tell you that it's copyrighted, and that you should get a copy of it. You could get one probably from bravenewbookstore.com. If you can't find it anywhere else, you can just call Brave New. Just get online, bravenewbookstore.com. And I think they can help you out there. Or you can go a step further. I mean, if you got a telephone there, you can just call them at 512-480-2503. If they don't have it, they'll get it for you. The number again is 512-480-2503. That's Brave New Bookstore in Austin, Texas. All right, now we're looking at Professor Hugo Munsterberg's observations from a book that he wrote back, you know, right after World War I, and it was entitled On the Witness Stand. And an attorney, a lawyer, by the name of Smith, spelled S-M-Y-T-H, first took the theory, it's a theory, on how to cross-examine, how to examine somebody who's telling the truth, who believes that he's telling the truth. Now, he isn't, he's lying, but he thinks he's telling the truth. How do you impeach that guy? How do you get the truth out of him? It's difficult. It's tough. But there's a technique for doing that, and it works. It works. And there's 23 of these techniques that we've discovered over the years. And so we write books, and that's what Wellman's doing here. He's writing a book, and he's saying, okay, well, now when we come up against a witness like this, and you've examined this guy, let's say on deposition, but we found out that the guy had some leading questions. And when the police are asking you leading questions, see, you can take these statements that you made to the police, and then you can ask the policeman. You can do the same thing to the policeman who believes he's telling the truth. And you can get the truth out of him, even though what he's telling isn't true, but he thinks it is. Now, we presume, and most people are honest, you know, most people like this Professor Allison here, he's not trying to come into court and lie. He thinks that what he's telling is the truth there. All right, so it was these obviously leading questions which prompted Mr. Smith to pursue the following line of cross-examination. He said, Dr. Allison, you were examined at the coroner's inquest about this accident, were you not? Allison said, yes, sir. Question, that was only 2 days after Professor McNulty was killed, was it not? Answer, I believe so. Question, your testimony then and now is substantially the same, isn't that so? Answer, that is true, of course. Question, was that the first time you had ever related the occurrence? Answer, yes, sir. Question, you have quite a large medical practice, have you not? Answer, fairly so, I believe. Question, do you have many nervous and mental cases come under your notice and care? Answer, oh yes, every physician does. Question, has that led you to take any particular interest in psychology generally, doctor? Answer, well, that is a subject which has always been of great interest to me. Question, then you have read considerably about it, have you not? Answer, yes, a great deal. Question, I suppose, of course, then, you must be familiar with Professor Munsterberg's recent book on the witness stand, which has created so much comment. Answer, yes, indeed. Question, do you remember the stress that he laid on the power of suggestion and the illusions of memory? And can you recall some of the curious examples that he gave of these phenomena? Answer, yes, if you will call my attention to them, I'm sure that I will. Well, question, for instance, reading from the book, Mr. Smith said or read, quote, this passage, it says, in the midst of a scholarly meeting, the doors open, a clown in highly colored costume rushes in mad excitement, and a Negro with a revolver in hand follows him. They both shout wild phrases. Then one falls to the ground. The other jumps on him. Then a shot, and suddenly both are out of the room. The whole affair, which was prearranged, took not more than 20 seconds. The scholars were asked immediately to write down a report of what they saw. Out of the 40 reports, there were only 6 which did not contain positive wrong statements. Only 4 noticed that the Negro had nothing on his head. The others gave him a derby or a high hat and so on. Different colors and styles of clothing were invented for him. Some said he had a coat on. Others said that he was in his shirt sleeves, and it was determined that a majority of the observers had omitted or falsified about half of the processes which occurred completely in their field of vision. Now, do you remember that example of the frailty of human memory? And Dr. Allison answered, yes, sir, I remember it well. Question. Then, do you remember this story? Still referring to the same book. A picture of a room in a farmhouse was shown to a class of picked students. Then each was asked questions as to what he had seen. Did you see where the stove was located? 59 out of 100 replied and gave the stove a definite place. Did you see the farmer's wife winding the clock? 30 of the class, 30%, described the clock and so on. There was neither stove nor clock shown in the picture. To the witness, you remember that, do you not? Answer, yes. That was one of his examples, which quite forcibly impressed me. Question. Now I'm going to burden you with the relation of one more incident from Dr. Munsterberg's book, and then I'm going to ask you if you can see the relation of these cases to the one at bar. Do you remember this further example from On the Witness Stand? Turning to another portion of the book, a Negro was being tried for murder, committed on a highway at night. A disinterested witness who claimed to have seen the whole occurrence was asked these suggestive questions on cross-examination. Question. Did you see by the moonlight the kind of trousers and coat the prisoner was wearing at the time? Answer. Yes. I'm sure they were brown or at least dark. As a matter of fact, there was no moonlight, and all the other witnesses who had testified earlier said that the prisoner's attire consisted of blue trousers, white shirt, and no coat. To the witness. Now, do you remember this example of the remarkable power of suggestion recorded by Professor Munsterberg? And Dr. Allison answered, yes, sir, I do. Question. Do you appreciate, Dr. Allison, that you are yourself easily subject to the power of suggestion? And Dr. Allison said, no, sir, I do not. Question. Well, Dr. Allison, let us see. Let me now call your attention to your testimony given 2 days after the tragedy at the coroner's inquest, which I will now read to you. So, counsel now reads his testimony as quoted above. Now, you recognize, do you not, that these questions, which for the first time brought out from you that you actually saw Professor McNulty going toward the elevator, were exactly of the kind classed as suggestive and exemplified in the book on the witness stand, do you not, Dr. Allison? Answer. Well, that may be, but what of it? Do you mean to imply that I am testifying falsely? Question. Not intentionally, no. But that you are what is known as a suggestible witness, Dr. Allison. Allison answered, prove it. Question. Very well. Would it surprise you to know that of the three instances that I apparently read from Dr. Munsterberg's book, and all of which you said you remembered perfectly? Well, only the first one was actually in the book. The second story was only half true, and the third story was an entire fabrication of my own. Here, take the book. Read it for yourself. And he handed the volume to Dr. Allison, the witness. Dr. Allison now hesitating, and his color rising. Mr. Smith, I'm afraid that you're making a fool of me. Question. Not more so than any one of us are liable to be honestly mistaken. But now let me ask you, Doctor, and I would not put this question to you if I were not convinced of your open and fair-mindedness and your honesty and integrity. In view of your answers, and looking back, and in the light of your scientific knowledge, can you really say that you actually saw Professor McNulty approaching the elevator shaft, or even saw him at all before the instant of his body disappearing down the shaft? And Dr. Allison answered after much hesitation, I'm afraid I cannot. The witness, with flushed countenance, then hurriedly left the witness stand. The main prop to the plaintiff's case were now gone, resulting in the jury finding a verdict in favor of Macy's and Company. Now, there's a lesson to be learned here. It is obviously the province of the cross-examiner to direct the nature of any foreign element which may have been imported into a witness's memory of an event or transaction to which he testifies, and if possible, to discover the source of that error, whether the memory has been warped by desire or warped by imagination, or whether the error was one of original perception, and if so, from whence did it arise, whether from a lack of attention or from a wrong association of previous personal experience. Not only does our idea of the past become inexact by the mere decay and disappearance of essential features, It becomes positively incorrect through the gradual incorporation of elements that do not properly belong to it. Sometimes it is easy to see how these extraneous ideas become imported into our mental representation of a past event. Suppose, for example, that a man has lost a valuable scarf pin. His wife suggests that a particular servant, whose reputation does not stand very highly, has stolen it. When he afterwards recalls the loss, the chances are that he will confess the fact with the conjecture attached to it and say that he remembers that this particular servant did steal the pin. Thus, the past activity of imagination serves to corrupt and partially falsify the recollections that have a genuine basis in fact. Now, a very striking instance of the effect of habit on the memory, especially in relation to events happening in moments of intense excitement, was afforded by the trial of a man by the name of Twitchell, who was justly convicted in Philadelphia some years ago, although he was convicted by erroneous testimony. In order to obtain possession of some of his wife's property, which she always wore concealed in her clothing, Twitchell, in great need of funds, murdered his wife by hitting her on the head with a slug shot. He then took her body to the yard, and he bent a poker, and then he covered it with his wife's blood so that it would be accepted as the instrument that inflicted the blow. And having unbolted the gate leading to the street, he left it ajar, and then he went to bed. Well, in the morning when the servant arose, she stumbled over the dead body of her mistress, and then in great terror, she rushed through the gate into the street and summoned the police. The servant had always been in the habit of unbolting this gate the first thing every morning, and she swore on trial that she had done the same thing upon the morning of the murder. Now, there was no other way the house could have been entered except through this gate. And the servant's testimony was therefore conclusive that the murder had been committed by someone from within the house, and Twitchell was the only other person in the house. Now, after Twitchell's conviction, he confessed his guilt to his lawyer and then explained to him how careful he had been to pull back the bolt and then leave the gate ajar for the very purpose of diverting suspicion from himself. The servant, in her excitement, had failed to notice both that the bolt was drawn and that the gate was open, and in recalling the circumstance later, she had allowed her usual daily experience and habit of pulling back the bolt to become incorporated into her recollection of this particular morning, even though it was false. Now, it was this piece of fallacious testimony that really convicted the prisoner. As the day of the execution drew near, Twitchell complained to the prison authorities that the print in the prison Bible was too fine for him to read, and he requested that his friend, a druggist, be allowed to supply him with a Bible in larger type. So his friend saturated some of the pages of this Bible with corrosive sublimate. Twitchell rolled these pages up into balls, and with the aid of water, he swallowed them. Death was almost instantaneous. Boswell, in his Life of Dr. Johnson, has related the particulars of his first meeting with Dr. Johnson, whom he had long been very desirous of seeing and conversing with. At last, they accidentally met at the house of Mr. Davies. Well, Mr. Arthur Murphy, in his essay on the life and genius of Dr. Johnson, likewise gives a description of Boswell's first meeting with Johnson concerning Murphy's account of the matter. Now, the reason I bring this to your attention, these two or three cases, is that this power of suggestion and the power of habit are very powerful. and there is a modality by which we can expose these manifest inaccuracies if we put our minds to it. If you have the training, if somebody said, well, let me show you how to do that. Our perception that there's no justice in America because of the police interrogation or because of the prosecutors using the adversarial system in place of the justice system is just plain false. Our expectation that the prosecutor is going to be honest and forthright and that the policeman is always going to tell the truth is false. And the burden is upon us to prove that we're innocent. You've been told all your life, the government has to prove you're guilty. We don't have to prove we're innocent. That's false. Wake up. Smell the coffee. In the justice system, that's true. It's not true in the adversarial system. In the justice system, the prosecutor should be working just as hard to prove that an innocent person is innocent as he would to prove that the guilty person is guilty in a justice system. But in the adversarial system, that's not his job, nor is that his duty. And he does not perform any justice duties in the discharge of his obligations. Neither does the policeman. The policeman and the prosecutor are both trained professionals. They have a job to do, and they do it, and they do it well. And their job is to convict you. It is not to prove that you're innocent. That's for your attorney to do. He is your advocate. You are your advocate. It's up to you to prove you're innocent. But we still use the old justice system, the belief that, well, it's up to the government to prove me guilty. I don't have to prove my innocence. And that's, of course, false in the under the adversarial system. Now, this example here of the servant who went through the unbolted gate, had she told the truth that she ran out, the gate was unbolted, And I don't know why it was unbolted, but it was. She testified that the gate was bolted and that she had opened the gate and ran out and got the police. And that's because that's what that woman had done every day, day in, day out, until it became a habit. And then she testified as to her habit. She did not testify as to what she knew, what she saw, or what she heard. She testified to what she believed, which was erroneous. Now, in this case, it turned out for the good. That happens once in a while. You know, even God and Big Mike once in a while step into the picture. But the general rule is that when you're testifying from memory, it will probably be incorrect, as we saw with in the last program with this guy Fuller. Very first thing out of his mouth was, when Fuller testified, is no, his application for employment with the government was not verified. Then when he was showed the document, oh yeah, that's right, it was verified. Now it happens that he lied on his application for employment anyway. And so, upon cross-examination, all of those lies were exposed. And the examiner had the information. He knew what he was looking for when he walked into trial. He wasn't just shooting from the hip. When we go in and we ask these questions on either direct or cross-examination, we do not go in there shooting from the hip. We already know the answer before we ask the question. But so that you can see it and understand it, the examples have been set out here in the book, The Art of Cross-Examination. The Art of Cross-Examination by Francis Wellman. So let me give you the vital details again. You know, you may never train yourself as a litigant. You may never be accused of murder or be accused of a crime. And life may go on for you without any problems. But you need to understand, 2% of everybody in America drawing breath, 2%, two people out of every 100 are going to be arrested at some point in their life. 2%. Do you know how often that 2% are arrested? Every year. 2% of Americans are going to be arrested this year. And that is the point in their life that they're going to be arrested. This year, 2%. Two people out of every 100 are going to be arrested in the year 2008 in the United States of America. Well, what does that translate out to be? Well, that means that everybody that's 50 years old, is going to be arrested once. Got that? Boys and girls, statistically, you're going to be arrested once in your lifetime for certain, and twice in statistical probability. And when that happens, and you find yourself face to face with the police, how are you going to handle it? You know, the average Joe Sixpack doesn't have a clue. He goes into the police station, and he's just totally bewildered, and the police take advantage of it. They take advantage of your bewilderment. And then you sit there, and you start spouting off, and they're taking down every word. 25% of what you're telling them is false. They ask you that three times, and they get three false statements. Then they come into court and testify against you about all of your lies, just like they did Martha Stewart. Remember, Martha Stewart now wasn't convicted for insider trading. She was convicted of lying. Got that? Convicted of lying. She never had any duty to talk to the police to start with. She didn't know what her rights were. The woman's a billionaire. Hadn't got a clue as to what her rights are. Legally, she's as dumb as a box of rocks. Martha Stewart, worth $2 billion. Dumb as a box of rocks. She was dumb forever opening her mouth and talking to the FBI. She should have asked the question, am I the subject of a criminal investigation? And they would have said, no, you're not. Good. Then I don't want to talk to you. Period. Get out of my life. Now, if they said, yes, you are the subject of a criminal investigation, then I reserve all of my rights at all times, and I waive none of my rights at any time, for any cause or reason. Now I don't want to talk to you. I don't like you. Butt out. Leave me alone. But she didn't. And she went in there just like all Americans do. And she talked. And 25% of the time she was lying. Even if she wanted to tell the truth, 25% of the time she wasn't. Remember, the book is called The Art of Cross-Examination. And the author is Francis Wellman. Francis Wellman, The Art of Cross-Examination. Ask for it at Barnes & Noble. And if you can't find it, go to BraveNewBookstore.com. BraveNewBookstore.com. Hey, we're out of time again. Children, we're going to have to leave it right here by reminding you that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard worldwide over the Internet daily. For more information about the law school and the Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, if you'd like more information, why don't you call and ask for our free general law CD package. It's free of charge. All you got to do is call and ask for it. The number to call, 417-273-4967. Now, the Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. All right, time's up. We got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.